Hi, I'm Marvin Olney, host of To The Point in Which Way LA, and thanks so much for listening to our programs. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film awards season, I've got a podcast for you to check out. It's called The Treatment, hosted by Elvis Mitchell. He goes beyond the plot to understand what inspires the actors, the filmmakers, the producers, and others to do what they do. You can find The Treatment on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
The grand old party takes charge on Capitol Hill. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Now controlling both houses of Congress, Republicans might try for some compromises with the Obama White House to prove they can really govern. Or they might choose continued gridlock, assuming that voters will blame the president when things inevitably go wrong. Guaranteed points of contention are the Keystone XL pipeline, Obamacare, and executive actions on immigration and climate change. Many new members have their own agendas. Today we'll begin to learn what they'll demand of their more experienced leaders. Today's talking point, terrorism, crime, and corruption in the global village. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To The Point. Even before Republicans finished choosing their new leaders today, President Obama invited them to the White House on Tuesday of next week. Will GOP control of both houses mean a new era of friendship or two more years of paralysis and gridlock? Today's talking point, gangsterism and terrorism blur together. That's according to an award-winning reporter, Sebastian Rotella, whose latest novel ranges from Buenos Aires to Paris to Baghdad. We'll hear how it reveals unsavory connections in the real world. First is news update. Despite appeals from Chancellor Angela Merkel, from churches and business leaders, thousands of Germans turned out in Berlin, Dresden, and other major cities last night to protest what they call the Islamization of Europe. There were counter-demonstrations as well. Allison Smale is Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. Allison, good to have you with us.
Yes, hello.
This is all about immigration, right?
Well, it's a complex thing. I think really that the people in Dresden have been driven onto the streets by fear of something that is really not happening in their immediate vicinity. Dresden itself is not one of the cities in Germany with a large immigrant population. And if they fear Islamization, there are even fewer Muslims there. But I think what it really is about is the perennial question of German identity. Germany has changed a great deal in the past two decades, and people in the former East Germany, which is where Dresden is located, have been through reunification and a complete change of system. They just about feel, I think, their cities are back in order, they've got jobs, they got used to the new system, and now along comes a whole wave of refugees, many of them from the wars in Syria and Iraq. Germany, by its Nazi past, is obliged, feels very obliged to take these people in. Plus, it actually needs immigration because there's a demographic crisis here. There won't be enough workers without immigration. But these people who are out on the streets feel as if they've been had this all decided for them, and it's going to create a Germany that they won't recognize.
Is there a different sense, a different reason for protest in the western part of the country than there is in Dresden?
Well, I think what happened in the western part of the country, I mean, first of all, you do have in places like Cologne or cities in the old Ruhr industrial area of western Germany, where there are a great many immigrants who, by and large, have integrated and do not, this is not a cause of trouble. But you have their presence. You also, because they are integrated, have a lot of people who are prepared to go out on the streets and counter Pegida and say, we actually disagree. We welcome immigrants. We want to give shelter to people who are escaping wars and hardship. So it has touched a nerve, and it's touched a nerve because it's touched a nerve about what the country is.
Tell us more about Pegida. What is that?
It's an obscure grassroots movement, murky. Its leader is a man called Lutz Bachmann, who is in his early 40s and had, in fact, had a number of not totally minor criminal convictions in his past. He seems to have organized together with 11 other people, they call themselves the Orga team of Pegida, this movement, which has successively attracted more and more people each Monday that it has held marches. They have cleverly drawn on a cry from 1989 when East Germans were rebelling against their communist government then and cried, "Wir sind das Volk," we are the people. And that cry now resonates anew. As Chancellor Merkel noted in her New Year's address, however, the people who are shouting this now mean something different, at least in her mind, than the 1989 demonstrators did. And she, in fact, urged her countrymen, her compatriots, quite clearly to steer away from these rallies. And she accused the organizers of having prejudice, coldness, and even hatred in their hearts, which was very unusually direct language for the Chancellor.
You said that the nation in general feels obliged because of its Nazi past to take care of people who are fleeing wars, such as the Muslims who are coming to that country now. How did that express itself, and did they make overt gestures indicating that they were opposed to the anti-immigrant protest?
No, and in fact, it must be said that the Pegida people have published on the web, although they have not read out to a meeting, I don't think, 19 points, one of which stresses, for instance, that they welcome refugees from wars. Quite interesting to read through that list of 19 points, which, as I say, have not been read at meetings. I think they have not been read at meetings for the reason that they might not go down so well with some of the people in the crowd. They sound extremely reasonable, and Pegida leaders, in the few public remarks that they have made, and they're quite picky about who they have interviews with, have stressed that they do not resent foreigners. But a lot of the parole and a lot of the words that are spoken at their rallies are considerably less friendly.
Alison Smale again, New York Times Berlin Bureau Chief. Thanks so much for being with us. You never know when you're going to be interrupted by electronic music in this era. Great to have you. In a moment, the grand old party takes charge on Capitol Hill on To the Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and I'll be back with To the Point. Republicans today are taking charge of both houses of Congress for the first time since 2006, with their biggest congressional majority since the end of World War II. But House Speaker John Boehner was faced with a substantial challenge from the right-wing members he calls the Hell No Caucus. Manu Raju is senior congressional correspondent for Politico. Hi, it's good to have you back on our program.
Great to be here.
Took a little longer than had been anticipated. How many people ultimately voted against the speaker?
25 altogether Republicans voted against him. And it was a wide range of people whom those 25 Republican dissenters voted for. People as varied as Congressman Daniel Webster, Jim Jordan, Louie Gohmert, and even Kentucky Senator Rand Paul got a vote to be speaker. And it really wasn't about a candidate. They didn't have a unified candidate to run against the speaker. It was a protest vote from the Tea Party right of the Republican conference in the House. saying that, hey, we don't like the compromises that the Speaker took in the last Congress, and they're warning him that if he does the same thing in the new Congress, that kind of opposition he can expect next time around when he runs for Speaker again, presumably in the future, or when he tries to cut deals with Democrats in the next 2 years.
According to Roll Call, one of the members, Randy Weber of Texas, says he's already been retaliated against, that the Speaker's office called and said he can't be the lead sponsor of a nuclear energy bill. After all, the Speaker's office is denying that any such thing happened, but that suggests that there's a lot of unhappiness.
Yeah, and that's kind of the way things go, and why leaders typically stay in power for a long time. A lot of these members are very worried about the retaliation. I mean, remember that the leadership decides which committees the members serve on. They also help determine the floor schedule, what bills get considered and get voted on. And if you're on the bad side of the leadership, chances are you're not going to get a lot of things considered. So that's one way that these folks stay in power. And that's one of the reasons that we've seen on both sides of the Capitol, the same folks who have run Congress over the last several years will continue to run this next Congress.
Well, if 25 people came out against the Speaker directly in this vote, is that enough to derail potential compromises, if there are any, with the White House or with the Senate?
You know, not at this point, because, you know, what we've noticed is that that we've seen after the election was that the House Republicans were able to expand their majority. And in some ways, Boehner is more secure despite this vote that happened in the House because of that larger majority in the House. He can now afford to lose folks in the far right of his conference and try to still try to push legislation through. Of course, he's got to limit those defections, and it will limit how far he can go to the middle and try to push legislation through. But because of that larger majority that they won, Boehner in a lot of ways has a little bit more wiggle room to actually push through legislation. We'll see how they try to accomplish that, though, that in the coming months.
Okay, so the Republicans increased their control of the House. They took control of the Senate for the first time in many years. What happened over there?
Today was a very ceremonial day. A lot of pomp happening in the Senate. Folks, senators being sworn in, the new Senate class, both the freshmen and the folks who won their re-election in 2014 were sworn in. Joe Biden came to do the ceremonial swearing in as well. So it was a lot of that. But we actually, there was a little bit of legislative action that kind of foreshadows the fights that Mitch McConnell is going to have in the coming months. Specifically over the Keystone Pipeline. That is the first bill that McConnell wants to bring to the floor next week. And what we saw was that McConnell wanted his Energy Committee to have a hearing tomorrow, but Democrats objected to having that hearing tomorrow. So that hearing is scrapped because the Democrats don't like that bill. And the White House also issued a veto threat over the Keystone Pipeline bill. So already you're seeing kind of the battle lines being drawn in the very first piece of legislation on the very first day of the new Congress.
Just should point out that the Speaker has to be elected because that's a congressional requirement. That's not true of the Senate, and they chose their leadership before the end of the year. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And in both Mitch McConnell, the new majority leader of the Kentucky Republican, was unanimously supported by his conference by voice vote. Similarly, Harry Reid was also elected to his post as minority leader, but he faced dissension from six Democrats who were frustrated with his leadership style. He faced some threats of his own, but both of those two men who have been running their respective caucuses will continue to do so in this new Congress.
What are the other things that are likely to come up most soonest in the Senate, where, among other things, they have to confirm presidential appointments?
That's right. And Loretta Lynch is at the top of the list. She's, of course, the president's nominee to be attorney general. And that is one of going to be the big flashpoints of the new Congress, exactly how Republicans deal with that. I was talking to a number of key Republican senators today, including Orrin Hatch, who's now the president pro tem of the Senate and sits on the Judiciary Committee that will consider the nomination. And he's inclined to support her nomination, as are several other Republicans. So it appears that Democrats at this point may have the votes to confirm her. But I should caution, she has not had her confirmation hearings. The Republicans want to push her very hard on issues like immigration, and you're going to see lots of presidential nominees have a hard time getting confirmed if the Republicans are opposed to the administration's policies. They may hold up a nomination for leverage to try to push the administration to back off some of these policies.
On the other hand, they might support Loretta Lynch because they'll be glad to see the last of the current incumbent attorney general.
That actually helps her case as well. A lot of Republicans are saying that, look, she can't be, in their view, any worse than Holder, so why not at least give Loretta Lynch a chance?
Manu Raju, a senior congressional correspondent for Politico. It's great to have you on our program. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you.
Charles Babington has just joined us. He's political congressional reporter for the Associated Press. Familiar voice to our listeners, Chuck Babington. Good to have you back.
Always good to be here, Warren.
So we just heard from Manu Raju about the election of the speaker. He says that perhaps even though he got 25 votes against him, Boehner may be more powerful this time around than he was before.
I think Manu's right. His majority is bigger. Quite a few of the new members are establishment type of members, Republicans who are going to support him. And, you know, if this thing had gone right down to the wire and, you know, one vote would tip it one way or the other, I think some of those 25 probably would have either not voted or cast their vote for Boehner. So you can't be sure that that's you might not read too much into that total.
There are a lot of new members of Congress. Tell us a bit about the makeup of the lower house in terms of race, religion, and other distinguishing characteristics.
Well, there are more women in Congress than ever before. That's including the House and the Senate. That's not too surprising. That number, for the most part, keeps growing over time. There's some greater diversity. There's the first black female House member, Mia Love.
Who's a Republican?
Yeah, a Republican. I'm sorry. Yes, the first black Republican female, precisely. And so the Congress continues to be somewhat slowly, perhaps, but become more diverse, at least in ethnicity, and even as it becomes more partisan, divided in terms of sort of ideology.
Is it religiously any different than it has been in the past?
You know what? I confess I've not looked up those numbers. I would have to look up those exact figures, Warren.
Okay. Apparently, it is roughly as it has been in the past, which I guess is what you would expect. But these are people who have not necessarily come up through the chairs, as I understand it. A lot of them have jumped in, particularly to the Senate, not necessarily from long service in the House, but in with shorter terms in the House or no service in the House at all.
Yeah, that's true in some ways, Warren. Quite a few of them are coming along, but not spending as much time, perhaps, climbing the ladder as many traditional politicians do through county politics, through the state legislature, then through the U.S. House, that sort of thing. At the same time, there's more senators now than ever before. 53 to be exact, are former U.S. House members. Now, that's only one higher than it has been before, but that. So, and on the one hand, you do have a number of lawmakers, especially senators, who have come from diverse routes. At the same time, you do have some institutionalists who complain that the Senate is becoming too much like the House. Now, that, you know, a House member wouldn't be too persuaded by that argument. But there is an argument that especially sort of some of the Senate old-timers make that they actually wish more members would come to the Senate by other routes, maybe being a governor or something like that. And they are concerned that in many ways the Senate is becoming more sort of divided along strict party lines without as much independence as there has been in the past. And that's generally a feature of the House. There are several reasons for that, but that is a complaint that you do hear.
Let's get back to the issues involving the Republicans in the Congress, which they now control both houses of, and the White House. For the first time today, the White House indicated that the president will veto the Keystone XL pipeline bill, at least as in its current form.
That's a significant step, Warren. Maybe not a huge surprise. The White House had been hinting for some time that it had a lot more negative things to say about Keystone XL pipeline than positive things. So maybe not a big surprise, but a big step nonetheless because, as you know, despite winning solid majorities in the House and the Senate, Republicans still have two big hurdles to getting things done the way they want them done. One of those hurdles is the filibuster power of the Democrats in the Senate, and the other, of course, is Obama's veto, which he's not had to use for 6 years, but now he can use it, and it's a very powerful tool. It's extremely difficult to override a veto. And so, you know, the Keystone Pipeline, because it does, it has almost universal Republican support and has some Democratic support, that was looked at as one thing, a significant thing that might be enacted, but it would require the president's signature, and now he said it's not going to happen.
Mitch McConnell, though, the new majority leader, says he will allow a lot of debate on the Keystone XL pipeline, and a lot of amendments have been proposed. Is it possible that the Democrats could get sufficient amendments that the president might go for the bill ultimately?
You know, I guess it's conceivable, but I don't really know, Warren, how you would you either build that pipeline or you don't. I've not heard that suggested. It does seem like this is a fairly finite type of proposal. I'm not sure they could tweak that enough. But you make a good point. McConnell has promised to open the Senate back up to what they call regular order. Now, this sounds very insidery, and it is, but it does have a significant impact on both politics and on policy, because it allows members to bring amendments to the floor to have a more vigorous debate about a bill. It also opens the way for, you know, political mischief, because let's face it, and it's gone on for years and both parties have done it, but some of the amendments that they bring to the floor are really designed pure and simple to make a very difficult vote for the other party. And that's why the Senate, especially under Harry Reid, had gotten away from that. They were so tired of this games, you know, games of having these politically motivated amendments. McConnell has said, you know what, that's the lesser of the two evils, and he'd rather go ahead and open the door to more amendments, even if it means also opening the door to more political mischief.
Chuck Babington again with the Associated Press. Jeffrey Lord is with us, former Reagan White House political director, now contributing editor for The American Spectator and a writer for The Conservative Review and Newsbusters as well. Jeffrey Lord, good to have you.
Thanks for having me, and Happy New Year.
It's Happy New Year to you. What about the Republicans? Are they going to have a Happy New Year, do you think, now that they control both houses, given what we have heard so far?
I have a feeling it's going to be a mixed blessing here, because I think, as this Boehner challenge indicated, there is a group within the House and doubtless within the Senate who will make life challenging for both Speaker Boehner and Senator McConnell. They'll be all together on some things and then less so together. I'm thinking of Ted Cruz, for example, on others, when you were mentioning the new attorney general. I will be interested to see if he takes any action on that. And, of course, you get back to the question of whether they will restore the right to filibuster or not. I think there's going to be some division on that as well, with a lot of people saying that the Democrats took it away, let's leave it gone, and this way it's easier to block nominations and things of that nature. So it's going to be very interesting just within the Republican caucuses alone.
You mentioned Ted Cruz, the Republican from Texas. How complicated will the fact that there's no, at the moment, official Republican running for president and a lot of competition to be the nominee?
Yeah, I mean, that always complicates things, and particularly when you have people in the chamber itself that are running for president. And you know, right away you think of Ted Cruz, you think of Rand Paul. There may be one or two others. You know, they always say that once you get to the Senate, every senator shaves the president in the morning. I imagine that you will have presidential politics injected into this slowly but steadily.
You work for Ronald Reagan. Now, there is no such figure riding into the foreground now from the political distance.
No, there isn't. And, you know, I noticed a while back Fox News had a screenshot of those who were interested in the Republican nomination, interested in running. There were 24 people on that screenshot, which I found absolutely stunning.
It's hard to get them all on the screen. Excuse me for interrupting,
exactly.
But we need to go to a break. We're talking with Jeffrey Lord, sure. Formerly with the Reagan White House, now with the American Spectator and other magazines. We'll be back. We'll continue this conversation with him and Charles Babington. We'll also talk with Cliff Schechter, who is a Democratic consultant, on our talking point later. Terrorism, crime, and corruption are related all over the world. We'll talk with novelist and reporter Sebastian Rotella back in a moment with To the Point from PRI. Thank you.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the opening of the Congress with the Republicans now in charge of both houses. And just before we went on the air, John Boehner was reelected as Speaker of the House. 25 people voted against him, more than expected, but not enough to prevent his reelection on the first ballot. And he now has a bigger majority in the House than he has in the past. He addressed the House saying that his agenda is going to include, or the Republican agenda will include, developing North American energy, restoring hours of the middle class, and helping small business to hire veterans. And he had this to say.
I'm going to invite the president to support and sign these bipartisan initiatives into law. It'll be a good start, and more. It'll be a sign that the logjam is breaking, and it will be a foundation on which to address the bigger challenges in the pursuit of freedom and security. No, this won't be done in a tidy way. The battle of ideas never ends and, frankly, never should. As Speaker, all I ask and, frankly, expect is that we disagree without being disagreeable.
Let me go back to Charles Babington, again, a political and congressional reporter for the Associated Press. Chuck, is the logjam breaking? Is there evidence for what the Speaker just said?
I think, you know, this is a day for hopefulness because it's an opening day of Congress, so it's a good time for pomp and ceremony and high hopes. I think it's going to be very difficult. Warren, as I mentioned earlier, some different types of tools will come into play, I think, to continue an awful lot of the gridlock that we've seen in the past. It was, the Republican House would pass bills and send them to the Democratic-controlled Senate for death, and they wouldn't get to the president's desk. Now, the Republicans can get some bills to his desk, although they've got to get past the filibuster hurdle in the Senate. But then he has the veto pen, and he's already, as we said earlier, on the Keystone Pipeline, a very important part of Boehner's energy agenda. So right away, you know, Boehner hadn't even taken the new gavel yet, and the White House had said, we're going to veto one of your highest priorities. The country is very divided, Warren, as you and your listeners know, and that plays out in the Congress and especially in the House. And, you know, this large number of Republicans, and it's divided not just Democrat and Republican, but within these parties. And that's why you saw a large number of Republicans vote against Boehner for Speaker. I think that's the new normal. I don't think in my lifetime you're going to see at least another Republican Speaker get 100% of his caucus's vote. It's just not going to happen anymore.
Let me introduce Cliff Schechter. He is a Democratic public relations consultant, columnist for the Daily Beast, author of The Real McCain. Cliff Schechter, good to have you with us.
Great to be back, Warren. Thanks.
The president already has invited the Republican leadership to come over to the White House on Tuesday of next week. Do you see him reaching out, or is the real message the one contained in the White House statement that he's going to veto the Keystone XL pipeline?
I think he's going to reach out legitimately. You know, there are issues in the future. He's already come out, and obviously he's in support of, for example, a Trans-Pacific Partnership, a new free trade deal that there are a lot of Republicans that would think the vast majority of them, maybe some on the far right, might not be in favor, but most will. And so, I mean, there will be areas where they can work together. But, you know, one needs to remember President Obama won originally in 2008 with a pretty large landslide and invited Republicans over, and nothing came out of it. They still, everybody, you know, went their own ways, and I would argue that was largely the Republicans' fault who got together initially after the election and said, we're not going to grant you a victory, and Mitch McConnell said, you're going to be, we want to make you a one-term president. Has that changed? Maybe that's changed somewhat now. I still think there are ways they can work together. I still think President Obama will legitimately reach out. But, you know, we could have another debt ceiling fight coming up as early as March. There still are a lot of areas of disagreement. And again, as some of your other guests have been talking about, there's enough diversity now between sort of establishment conservatives and really the far right of the Republican Party that there are a number of those who are going to jump off and refuse when it comes to compromising on a number of issues. So we'll have to see where it goes.
Jeffrey Lord, on the Republican side, do you think there will be another fight over the debt ceiling?
Yeah, I do think there will be. I think there are a number of issues, and that's one. And what's happened here is that the leadership on the Republican side has given sort of the impression to conservatives that they will always say, well, we can't fight on this, but wait till the next time and we'll get them. And then, of course, the next time comes along and then the same argument repeats. So I think at this point you're going to hear people saying, well, you gave us this the last time and the last time and the last time and the last time, so this time we're going to fight. Now, whether or not they can win that fight is another question altogether.
But there are intra-party fights as well. Cliff Schechter, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is something that a lot of Democrats oppose.
No, that's true, and I think you will see some of that. I mean, an example is on that issue. You may see progressive Democrats opposing it, and you may see, as I said, a couple on the right, I would say very conservative members of the Republican caucus opposing the trade deal, as well as look if they try to get together on spending measures, as they did in the past with a grand bargain. You know, really in the end, it was a coalition of some progressive Democrats and some very conservative Republicans who ended up blocking that. I think you're going to see a decent amount of that. It's not going to just be either Democrats blocking Republicans or Republicans going after Obama. You're going to see a lot of the sort of intra-party fights. And the problem is I think more often things will be blocked than will be supported that way.
Chuck Babington, I know you need to leave us relatively soon. Again, a congressional reporter with the Associated Press. What about the obligation that some Republicans have said they have to demonstrate, particularly after the second least productive congressional session in American history last time around, that they need to demonstrate that they can govern?
Yeah, that's something that you hear quite often, Warren, particularly in the Senate, where the members have more leeway. It's not as leadership-driven as the House is. You've got quite a few Republican senators who are up for re-election in 2016 from fairly swing states, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Ohio, Florida, others. These people in particular they don't want to have happen to them what happened to the Democrats in this past election of November, where the Republicans just clobbered them, the senators running for re-election, saying you didn't do anything, you didn't pass any bill, you didn't even get an amendment passed. And that's part of the McConnell's thinking, why he wants to open things up to give these types of members a chance to at least get some legislation to the floor, perhaps get a vote on it. Whether they can get a meaningful bill passed, again, with this Democratic president's signature is another matter. But there is quite a bit of talk among Republican leaders in the House and the Senate. We've got to show that we can govern, and that, you know, if we get a bill to the president and he vetoes it, you know, we can't be held accountable for him vetoing it. But at least let's do that and not fight among ourselves so much that we can't even get that much done.
All right, Chuck Babington again with the Associated Press. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Jeffrey Lord, back to you, our Republican. How much have things changed since you were in the Reagan White House? We hear about polarization. Does that seem now to have become institutionalized, even though there are those senators in the swing states and the states that Obama won that would like to be able to demonstrate they can govern? Doesn't the president always get blamed when things don't work?
Yes, he gets credit for the good things sometimes unfairly, and he gets blamed for the bad things sometimes unfairly. So yes, that always happens. The president is the predominant figure in the government, so that certainly happens. And I do think things are a little more partisan. Although I must say, Ronald Reagan certainly had his share of these kind of difficulties, and he had his share of difficulties with people in his own party. This is largely forgotten now, but for the first time since 1954, Republicans had won control of the U.S. Senate. And he had a whole series of what we would now call establishment Republicans in senior positions, Senator Domenici and Senator Baker and Senator Dole, et cetera, who were not always enthusiastic about President Reagan's policies. And in fact, you know, actively blocked them behind the scenes or stopped them or, you know, threw up roadblocks, which frustrated him to no end, which we now know. I mean, if you were there, you knew this, but now we know in his own handwriting here, because we have his diaries, and you go back and, you know, he would talk about how, well, I don't think they got the message today, that kind of thing. So this is not new, really.
Cliff Schechter, back to you, our Democratic public relations consultant. What are the strengths of President Obama at this point? He has been taking various direct actions that he's entitled to do under the Constitution, although some Republicans challenge all of the actions that he has taken. What more would you expect from him in terms of direct actions rather than allowing legislation to pass?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do expect there'll be more. I mean, you're obviously referring to one on immigration. There was the move towards relations with Cuba. There's a number of other things he can do. He can, you know, he's working right now on the issue of global warming, and he can have all sorts of different meetings with important players like China in that whole debate. He can go abroad and frankly do a lot unilaterally. And then look, there's other measures he can sign too. There's one that people have been debating in Washington that has to do with overtime pay, where he could, with the stroke of a pen, restore that to where it's 1970s levels and give 10 million people a pay raise. And there's a lot of people on the left pushing for that. That's something, for example, President Obama could do literally just with a signature. So there are a lot of other measures. Other presidents obviously have used this too. Certainly President Obama has used it pretty effectively recently to shore up support. I think his support just after the Cuba measure and the immigration measure among Hispanics in America shot up by about 10 or 15 points. So among kind of the key groups in his constituency, there's definitely a lot that he can do.
What about the Affordable Care Act? Republicans have voted to repeal it entirely any number of times. There's some indication that they might do that again. Are you worried about that in the Congress, or are you more worried, Cliff Schechter, about the challenge that may reach the U.S. Supreme Court?
I'm far more worried about the Supreme Court. I mean, they can vote to repeal it in the House and the Senate, and President Obama, of course, can veto it, or your guests said also, there can be a filibuster. That's not going to go anywhere. They might come to a compromise on one or two parts of Obamacare that they've discussed, but otherwise, I don't see that going. Or what I could see happening is I could see the five-member conservative majority of the Supreme Court saying that what amounts to a typo means that subsidies can't go to states that have their own Obamacare exchanges, and that, of course, would throw a huge wrench into Obamacare and cause a lot of problems. So, you know, if it's me, and it's the key here is making Obamacare work even better than it has and continue to thrive, then yes, the Supreme Court is certainly the biggest threat.
Complicated issue we don't want to go into, as you say. Some are arguing that all there is a typo. Others are saying that demonstrates the intent of the Congress. The U.S. Supreme Court has to deal with that because it is, of course, part of the law. Jeffrey Lord, back to you. How about the concern that the Louisiana representative, who's now the House Majority Whip, gave a speech to white supremacists in 2002. Is that going to damage the Republicans, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a problem for them. I myself have said that he should resign. As I understand it, there is some question as to whether he did speak to this group or whether it was another group in the hotel. However, there's just no question that a top aide, David Duke, gave him a $1,000 contribution and that he had some sort of relationship with the guy. I do think that's a problem. I think that, you know, there's a larger problem with him in terms of the sort of Washington culture and all this that you know, throws people out there and they'll meet with anybody without being totally cognizant of who they're meeting and what they're saying and all of that kind of thing. And I think he's gotten himself in trouble. So I do think that's a bit of a problem. But if Speaker Boehner has been reelected today, I have to say I think that there will be no question that Mr. Scalise will stay on. I wasn't sure there for a while over the holidays, but I think he will probably pass the exam.
We're talking about Steve Scalise, who is, again, from Louisiana, House Majority Whip, a very important figure in the leadership, accused at least of having met with David Duke, who has sort of tried to revive the Ku Klux Klan. Cliff Schechter, do you think the Democrats ought to make an issue out of that?
Well, they certainly already have, and I think they'll continue to. I think that the Republicans would frankly be better off if they would do what clearly was done with Michael Grimm, representative from Staten Island, where they convinced him in his case because of pleading guilty to a felony to step down. I think they would be in much better shape, because that's been something that maybe hurt a little bit, but it's something that's going away. And if they allow Representative Scalise to stay in the leadership, this is something that Democrats can continue to hammer home, as President Obama's spokesman Josh Earnest did twice in speaking the other day, as well as other Democratic leaders. So I agree, you know, that it looks like he's staying. I think if Republicans were smart, they would have him not stay.
Again, Jeffrey Lord has called for him to resign. Once again, Jeffrey Lord, you worked for a president. President Obama's approval ratings have now come up over 50% for the first time in some months. How important is that, do you think? And can he use that effectively as he tries to cope with this Republican-controlled Congress?
Yes, yes, he can. President Reagan went through the Iran-Contra situation in the last 2 years of his term, and for a while there, his popularity took a nosedive. He went on television and apologized to the American people, and you know, trust was restored, and his numbers went up. He left with a 63, 68, somewhere in their popularity rating. So yes, your ratings can help or hurt you a lot. And since his ratings have, since President Obama's ratings have, are apparently on the way up, that will help him. But you know, it all depends on the situation and you know what goes on in 2 years. If there is another scandal of some sort that's uncovered here, if some of these investigating committees now in hands of Republicans in the Senate hit on things with the IRS or who knows what, then that can be a problem.
Does the action with regard to Cuba help the president, Jeffrey Lord? Do you think?
You know, I don't think so. One of the curious things that I noticed in this, in the reaction to this, was the passion with which both Marco Rubio, the Republican from Florida, and Bob Menendez, who's the Democrat and was at the time chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, they were really angry with President Obama over this. And I think that that speaks to the political passion that this issue raises in the Cuban community in Florida and presumably in New Jersey. So I do think that that's going to be a bit of a problem for him.
On the other hand, Cliff Schechter, we have Latinos in general who seem to be supportive of it. And there's some argument that Menendez in particular was angry, partly because nobody told him about it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that Jeffrey's right when it comes to sort of the older Cuban community, but it seems at least, and obviously Marco Rubio isn't what I would call older, but when you look at polling that came out right after that was done, it seemed like, you know, you really had to start getting up to Cubans who were into their 60s and 70s who didn't want to have any, to extend any relations further with Cuba. And so I think in the end, you know, when you look at the kind of coalition the Democratic Party is appealing to, I think in the end this will be a net plus. As I said, you know, I can't sit there and pinpoint exactly, but it certainly seems that polling taken after the immigration move by President Obama, as well as after the Cuba move, you know, his numbers have gone up, certainly, and that's probably helped his overall numbers to go up where they have. So I think in the end it's going to be a net plus.
All right. The new congressional session has begun. The Republicans are now fully in charge. Some of the issues sound the same. Some of them sound quite different. Thank you all for being on our program and helping us get a preview of it. Cliff Schechter, again, Democratic Public Relations Consultant, columnist for The Daily Beast, author of The Real McCain. Jeffrey Lord, former Reagan White House political director, now with The American Spectator and Conservative Review and Newsbusters. And our earlier guest, Charles Babington of the Associated Press, Manu Raju with Politico. Great to have you all. Terrorism is partly an international business connected to drug trafficking and the corruption of governments in South America, the Middle East, South Asia, Europe, and the United States. We'll talk with a reporter whose new novel connects the dots in a moment on To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
We're only back with today's talking point. The Convert's Song is the second novel by Sebastian Rotella, whose first was Triple Crossing. Rotella is an award-winning foreign correspondent who's been LA Times bureau chief in Buenos Aires and Paris. He now covers international security for ProPublica. Rotella says his international thrillers are not journalism in disguise, but The Convert's Song does provide insights into the globalization of terrorism and organized crime. Sebastian Rotella, good to have you back on our program.
It's always a pleasure, Warren. Thanks very much.
One of the things you talk about, or that you dramatize, I should say, in the book, very effectively, I might add, is the blurring together, as you call it, of gangsterism and terrorism. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I've found, you know, as you said, having covered both mafias and terrorism and intelligence around the world, that those forces converge often in interesting ways, sometimes at the macro level and sometimes the micro level. So you might have a case like, say, the Madrid attacks in Spain in 2004, where you have a group of essentially Moroccan drug traffickers who radicalize quickly and become Islamic terrorists, and people are surprised by that, and then it catches everyone off guard. Or you might find a global phenomenon like the very murky far-flung networks that help finance Hezbollah, which are involved in cocaine trafficking and money laundering in Latin America and even North America and Europe and Africa. So it's a world that I find very fascinating, very complex, full of shadows and ambiguities, and it's very fertile ground in which to explore through fiction.
Your characters demonstrate that some people who are attracted by terrorism aren't necessarily doing it because of religion.
That's right. I mean, I think having spent a lot of time now looking at terrorism in different places and different profiles, there are different profiles in different places, but in the West in particular, I found that one thing that you see and that a lot of the experts tell you in intelligence and law enforcement is that as much as we think that this is a religious or an ideological phenomenon, a lot of it has to do with identity. A lot of it has to do with people looking to join, not unlike the mentality of someone, say, joining a street gang. And if you look at some of the people who are going to places like Syria and Iraq and in the past went to Pakistan or Afghanistan to join different terrorist groups, you see people who don't necessarily have a sophisticated understanding of religion, for whom the sort of the group dynamic of being of talking the talk and walking the walk, of being a holy warrior, gives some purpose to a life of violence or a life that is looking for meaning. And I think that's something that, as much as we sort of try and understand terrorism, still is a difficult concept for people to absorb. And that, again, was very challenging, a lot of fun to explore in fiction.
Your main characters grew up in America, but they are seen acting in a number of other places, including South America, Buenos Aires in particular, also in Europe and in Baghdad. They range around. And one of the things that they seem to depend on is the corruption of various law enforcement and intelligence agencies.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the way the world works, and there's different kinds of corruption. I mean, there's straightforward corruption in which people are trying to make money. There are the trade-offs that intelligence services make, whether they're the trade-off you make sometimes with a bad guy is to get a bigger bad guy. So there's the deals with the devil that happen all the time. There are then intelligence services that you see, as much as we talk about terrorism as kind of this stateless entity, a lot of the cases I've covered, ultimately what's really dangerous about terrorist groups is when they have an intelligence service backing them or letting them operate, like, say, Al-Qaeda has had, or other groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba have had support from Pakistani intelligence, or the role of Iranian intelligence in supporting groups. So there's different kinds of corruption, but absolutely. And I think those areas where terrorism, gangsterism, corruption, and intelligence converge are the areas where you really have to look to understand how these overlapping networks work and the power that they have.
I don't want to give away the plot in any way, but the characters certainly do demonstrate how it is that this very complex situation, reality that you have described, makes way for a lot of treachery. Nobody knows who to believe.
And that's what I found, you know. I mean, and I tried the main character one of the main protagonists, who's the convert of the title Raymond, who's an American of Argentine Lebanese descent, is very much inspired by a number of cases I've seen where you have these fascinating characters who exist in real life, but when you see their stories, they seem almost too melodramatic to be true. Who are part gangster, part informant, part terrorist, who systematically seduce and betray and who manipulate the manipulators and they're recurring figures. Sometimes they're big times, big time arms traffickers. Sometimes they're more small time, but they are the stories that you really have to understand, the characters understand to understand how that world really works. And I had a lot of it was very interesting for me to play with my hero being not, you know, having some of the skills that someone like that to function in that world, you have to have some of those skills. And the question of hanging on to ethics and you know, dealing in that world of treachery, but still sort of not crossing the line into wrongdoing is a very difficult challenge, and it's a very powerful one to explore with the authority and liberty that fiction gives you. So I had a lot of fun telling the story and sort of letting the character drive the action in that sense.
It's hard to know which side of the line people are on, or even if there is a line, but they all know different cultures, they know different languages, they can almost assume different identities. In fact, one of them does.
I think that's, you know, and that goes to this idea that, you know, we talk so much about today about radicalization and why you have all these young people from around the world going to Syria to join the Islamic State and these groups that are doing these horrific things. And it gets back to that question of identity and people trying to establish identity and the idea of tribe, you know, and globalization as being something that's a powerful force. So you have people you look at the melting pot of people who are going to Syria. You have converts from Chile and people from Russia and people from France and people from Ohio. And I wanted to look at some of those forces, both in terms of what we're seeing in the news, but also, you know, to try and understand the psychology of that. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the great issues of our time, is this question of identity and tribe, and I think it drives a lot of the conflicts we see playing out in real life.
Just a couple of seconds left, but with all that you describe, it is more difficult than one might imagine for law enforcement, those people who really do want to stop terrorism, to function and be successful.
I think that's one of the things that, you know, you see more and more, is that the networks, the mafias and the terrorists, you know, move across borders with much more agility than law enforcement and intelligence agencies do, and it's always kind of a game of catch-up.
Sebastian Rotella, once again, the book is The Convert's Song. He is now a reporter with ProPublica. It's great to have you on our program again. Good luck with the book.
Thanks very much, Warren. It's a pleasure.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.